Yadi Dhancha Thari Purisa Yugani Atta Purisa Bhugala Esa Bhagavato Savaka Sangho Ahuneyo Ahuneyo Dakineyo Anjali Karaniyo Anutaram Punyam Ketam Lokasa Tamahan Sangam Abhipujayami Tamahan Sangam Sirasanamam.
This is what should be done by one who is skilled in goodness and who knows the path of peace. Let them be able and upright, straightforward and gentle in speech, humble and not conceited, contented and easily satisfied, not busy with duties, and frugal in their ways, peaceful and calm, and wise and skillful, not proud and demanding in nature. Let them not do the slightest thing that the wise would later reprove, wishing in gladness and in safety, may all beings be happy. Whatever living beings there may be, whether they are weak or strong, omitting none, the great or the mighty, medium, short or small, the seen and the unseen, those living near and far away, those born and to be born, may all beings be happy. Let none deceive another, or despise any being in any state. Let none through anger or ill will wish harm upon another, even as a mother protects with her life her child, her only child, so with a boundless heart should one cherish all living beings, radiating kindness over the entire world, spreading upwards to the skies and downwards to the depths, outward and unbounded, free from hatred and ill will, whether standing or walking, seated or lying down, free from drowsiness. One should sustain this recollection. This is said to be the sublime abiding, by not holding to false views, the pure-hearted one, having clarity of vision, being free from all sense desires, is not born again into this world. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu.
A new microphone. We use this over in Bodhinyana. Still got some echo though. Things may be too loud. Okay, in the room over there. Come on. So the first question is, why can't we get a good PA system? Okay, okay. How's that? Okay, they're in there messing around. Anyway, according to the suttas, each of the Brahma-viharas is different in quality. For example, upeka contentment is more sublime than the low one. Also, in comparison, the compassion is more sublime than loving kindness. Please comment. Thank you. Well, it doesn't matter if it's one is more sublime. I reckon they're all pretty much equal in the sense that loving kindness has loving kindness has everything. It's almost like I would think that compassion and sympathetic joy and contentment or equanimity, they are just pretty much sort of just different aspects of the same thing, like different facets of the same beautiful giving your energy for the sake of all others, not keeping any goodness inside of you just for yourself, but spreading it around. So like metta, may all beings be happy and well. And compassion, those beings who are suffering, that includes all beings. So that means that we always take compassion, karuna, just to actually be included in metta. And the lovely one, just that really deserves being separated out or like focused on, is just the successful beings in this world. The ones who are having a wonderful time. Wow, well done. That, you know, that people here are getting into deep meditation and getting nimittas and stuff. Isn't that amazing? Isn't that wonderful? And maybe not you, but for all other beings, they're getting somewhere. And that gives, you know, so much happiness and joy. So that's, I always say that you've got an alternative of jealousy. Yeah, just why her? You know, she hasn't given any dana, she doesn't keep precepts, I know what she gets up to, and she gets jhanas and stream winning, and that's just really unfair. I've been supporting this Buddhist society and this monastery for such a long time, and they come along and just jojos come in, blow-ins, and they just get jhanas. This is really unfair. I do all the effort and stuff, and they do nothing at all, and they just say they got jhanas. This is just too much. Could you understand that? It doesn't matter, but you know what it's talking about. So that is called jealousy. And that is just a waste of energy. Sometimes when somebody does something really good, have a beautiful meditation, it just makes me feel so good, wonderful, yay! And then I get happiness through other people's merits. In other words, I must give this to the Sri Lankan Buddhism. Because just over in Thailand, maybe I didn't really realize this when I was in Thailand, but they would give sort of an offering, and you know, they would say, yeah, very good. But when in Sri Lanka, they give an offering, you know, just, they give an offering, and they just wouldn't give it to the monk. They'd pass it all around, first of all. And everyone would touch it, go, sadhu, and go, sadhu. So you got a piece of the offering. We're actually doing nothing except just rejoicing in other people's goodness. And I thought that was a wonderful tradition that was. So there's some people who are wealthy, some people are really poor. It doesn't really matter. You know, somebody wealthy, they just give a big check for something or other. And instead of just them giving it, you pass it around and pass it around. And if it's if it just survives that and there's something there... No, I'm talking about... They pass it around. When it gets to the Sangha, you know, we just accept it, we rejoice and give the blessing, and everybody touches it. They get, because you rejoice in other people's goodness, you get a huge amount of karma that way. Almost exactly the same as the person who actually bought it. And I thought that was just a beautiful, it's an equalizer. We're all people, they're poor or rich or in between. They can all make wonderful good karma. Because sometimes people say, oh, I wish I had some funds and I could actually help do this and help do that. But they're really poor. So it doesn't matter. You come to an alms offering and when somebody else is, you know, just offering something, you go, sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. And then actually you get part of the good karma. So it's a marvelous thing. It just means your heart, your joy, your purity of rejoicing in other people's goodness. That actually is the cause of that good karma. And that's like mudita, to see the wonderful people in this world today. Maybe not you yet. Maybe, you know, but this is... Sorry, there I go again. But it's wonderful people, you feel so joyful, so wonderful that, you know, that great things are happening. And that's a source of beautiful, that's pure energy, loving kindness. And that, of course, that's Brahma Viharas. You get really blissed out on that one. And like contentment. Ah, here you are, you've got another few days. Well, you're halfway through what day is it today anyway. You've got many days left, contentment. Another 4 or 5 days. Most people tomorrow morning, Tuesday, you have to go to work. You can have a sleep in tomorrow morning. And you don't have to face the traffic and the boss. Yeah, I don't really qualify as a boss. Do I? I don't give you a hard time. Do I? My own sort of view of myself, it might be distorted, but I always think, oh, just whatever you want to do. In other words, you're giving some kindness, and so you don't have to do anything. You don't have to cook any food tomorrow, it's all being bought for you, I don't know where from, and do a little bit of washing dishes, but not that much, you don't have to do cleaning. You don't have to do anything. Isn't this bliss? Oh, yeah. Content and easily satisfied. What more do you want? Just get a nice food, a cup of tea, a few jokes in the evening. Just, oh, this is bliss. It doesn't get better than this. So anyway, that's why I think they all get to the very end. Whichever one you do will reach just the ultimate. Because once you get the bliss coming up, the joy coming up, that's why there's if later on when we do a loving kindness meditation, usually do that at the end, something to look forward to. Actually, you shouldn't look forward to anything because that's going into the future, but nevertheless, you know what I mean. And it's also that, you know, you just to give loving kindness to all beings in the whole universe. And then you just give loving kindness and take away the object. Not to all beings, you just loving kindness. And that turns into the limitless. Disembodied, powerful loving kindness. A great limitless for that. And then, of course, jhana is easy after that. So, anyway, dear Ajahn, after a meditation session, we often do a transfer of merits to those who we think might need some help, especially departed relatives, in case they were reborn in a lower realm. This always seems like another form of intercessional prayer to me. Please explain how this works within the law of karma. If everyone is where they are because of their own poor karma and can only go where the karma they are now making sends them, how does someone else's merits change the outcome? So, I fall over and break a leg here in Jhana Grove. Now, my karmic merits means I haven't got any money and I haven't got a credit card. So, but fortunately, you can intercede for me. You can actually call the ambulance for me. Which means you, your karma, actually just intercedes for me. So this is the same. When somebody passes away, maybe your relation or even somebody you know, and then you can think of them and your powerful merits can actually help. So you share the merits, may they be happy and well. It is their good karma that they have a relation who's a Buddhist, who's a meditator, who has a powerful mind, who can actually send that loving kindness to them. That's your good karma that you know somebody like that. It's one of the reasons why, if any of you have a relation and you manage to get them to become a Buddhist monk or Buddhist nun, wow! You have just got such good karma. Because anyone in your family gets a bit sick, you just got somebody in the family to just really blast them with loving kindness and send really powerful sort of good karma to them. Because look, suppose, what's a good example? Suppose that you try and contact, Suppose you try and contact the Prime Minister of Sri Lanka to try and help. Could you do that? I could. I know him. He's a friend. I know how to get hold of him. So, if you know me, I can actually send these requests to powerful people who can help you. So that is why if you've got somebody like a monk who can actually spread that loving kindness, powerful people who can assist you. Because you know what my name means, Brahma Wangso? It means the lineage, the family of gods, of Brahmas. I've got relations in places. But it does actually work. How does it work? How many times? This is the best explanation of sharing of merits. How does it work? The mind does have power, but people don't believe how it works. If you do meditation, you know how it works, and my goodness, it is powerful. But everybody has that experience of somebody in your family or a close friend is hurt. And they're way over the other side of the world. But you know that something's wrong. Somehow or other you know that a family member is sick. You can feel it. And that was one of the examples of that. One of the best little stories was of this gentleman who was a vet in Melbourne. Because I read this in the Melbourne Age when I was visiting Melbourne many years ago. And it was a wonderful story. He was travelling from the city to some countryside retreat to have, you know, like a party with his friends. He was a single guy. And halfway on the journey, he just got overcome suddenly by this grief. He was just really upset. And he started crying. And of course, the crying was just so strong, he had to pull in the emergency lane of the motorway. And just to get himself together. And he was weeping and weeping and weeping. He didn't know why at all. It just came out of nowhere. And, you know, after about a quarter of an hour, half an hour, he was, you know, able to drive again. So he drove to the country house where the message was waiting for him. His dog had been hit by a car and killed. Exactly at that time, he was overcome with grief. And how did he know that? Suddenly there was some huge sadness overcame him exactly the time his dog, which was still in Melbourne, got hit by a car and killed. And some of you may have had those experiences, or certainly you know they're really common. And this is one of the reasons why you can see that just if it's someone who's really close to you, you know, you can basically contact them. Especially if there's a big, heavy trauma, then of course that contact, the mind is so strong, it can contact you pretty quickly and easily, the closer you are. So anyway, that's how that works. Much faster than email. It's M-mail, merit mail. Often, why do people worry out the good and the bad things when deciding to forgive someone? And the first thing that comes to mind is the bad things most of the times. How to help them see the good things first? That is just our psychology. Because when you're at school, that people point out your mistakes. Well, you made a mistake there, there's a fault there. Even that sometimes, you know, when I wipe my face, people say, I probably still got a bit of food over there. So what about the rest of my face? It's perfect. Why did you put that? So you can see we always look for what's wrong and the faults in life. And that means that we become this obsessed with fault finding. And so instead of that, don't find fault. Just find this beautiful goodness in every human being. It's not that hard to find. So that's one of the reasons when I went to prisons to teach. You saw those prisoners and they were just wonderful people. How can you say that, Ajahn Bhag? Some of the things these people did. Ah, yeah. But that's more than their bad stuff. You see way past the faults and see their beauty and their goodness and their kindness. And the amazing thing was, as soon as I saw that, they could hardly believe that, you know, actually someone liked them and respected them, wasn't afraid of them. They were murderers. I said, okay, yeah, well, you know, you're not a murderer, you're just a person who murdered somebody. Does that make you a murderer? One act? Or maybe two or three or four acts? Does that really define who you are? What else did you do the rest of your life? How many more acts have you done other than murdering? And sometimes you look at it a different way. Why do we define a person by, you know, terrible things they did, but that doesn't, there's no such thing as a terrorist. Now we're getting really sort of controversial. It's people who've done terrorist things. You know one, a couple of famous terrorists? George Washington. He was a subversive terrorist. If he hadn't have won, he'd have been gone down as insurrection. Nelson Mandela, he blew up infrastructure in South Africa. Are they terrorists? No one actually calls them that, because they're not terrorists. They are people. Actually, do you know that once, with my friend Christopher Nightingale, when I was 11 years of age, we made a bomb? I did, I made a bomb, and it worked. Actually, I didn't really make the bomb. I just supplied the tin can. And he was one of these people who was really smart in chemistry, way above, you know, his grade. And so just one morning, we went to the local park, and I supplied the tin. He supplied the chemicals. We put it in there, and we sort of lit something, and then boom! It went bang. And oh, I thought that was so cool. I thought, wow, I'd made my first bomb. And then the keeper of the park caught both of us. We were in big trouble after that. That was the end of my blossoming career in terrorism. I was only 11. Anyway, kids, boys being boys, it's very dangerous. You can't say it's a good thing to do, but I thought it was good at the time, especially when it went bang. It actually worked. First time. Anyway, the good and the bad things when deciding to forgive someone. So, you don't weigh them, you actually include them. And of course you all know that story, I keep on repeating it. Find a perfect tree in the forest. There's no perfect tree in the forest. There's no tree which hasn't got faults in it. And if you find that perfect tree, well, it's just, it must have Wait, there isn't one. It must be plastic, or it must be a fake one or something. Because trees aren't perfect. They're all over the place. They're twisted, they're bent. And the more bent and twisted, and the more damage there is on them, the more beautiful they are. The more character they've got. So good and bad people? They've all got some good and bad. And if they... And there's no such person as an all bad. There's no such thing. Even Adolf Hitler, he was a vegetarian. So, good, bad? Who knows, yeah. So there is all of these ones, how to help them see good things first. Don't see them first, see both of them. And just include good and bad, that's just natural. So forgiveness is your choice. They don't deserve or need forgiveness, but you need to forgive. It's your job. You're the one who is affected by forgiveness or carrying around the pain of the past. It's not your problem. It's not their problem. It's your problem. So, you make sure you forgive. Hello. No ghost stories tonight, please. Now, first of all, I do not follow instructions. So because you asked for having none, that's... No, okay. Is hiding the truth from someone with the intention to avoid any unhappiness the right speech? Hiding the truth. What was that? There was this philosopher, ethicist, who was in Amsterdam during the Second World War. He was giving refuge to a Jewish family, and when sort of the soldiers knocked on the door and said, are there any sort of people other than you and your family in this house? You know, he just would never lie. So he said, oh, come in and have a look for yourself. And I said, okay, thank you, sir, and went away. His honesty was so good. So even one of my examples, when I was coming back, this happened when I was over in Malaysia. I met a Burmese monk there who gave me some relics. And some relics, well, these were real relics because he'd found them in the jungle in Burma. And he knew my reputation, he said, look, I think, you know, you're the one, so you're sort of monk, I want you to take some relics back to Perth. So that is, you know, really authentic relics of the Buddha, and he found it in an ancient stupa, which had been overtaken by the jungle and had toppled over. And so, I came into Perth Airport, you know the little form you have to fill out, to declare if you take, you know, any alcohol or any other sort of stuff into the country. And so I looked at it there and I said, bodily parts. So I did a tick. That's honest. So you know, you're taken to the where they check everything. It says on the form here you've got bodily parts. What have you got in here? It said bones, human bones. I said, let's have a look. And I got this out and said, whose bones are they? You know, the Buddha's bones. At which point, you know, the guy shaking his head, I'd better bring the supervisor over. Too much for me. So they brought the supervisor over. I said, what's the problem here? He said, oh, this gentleman, this monk, has got sort of bones of the Buddha with him. Human bones. And they said, well, you know, they're human bones. I told him a story, and he had a look at them, and they're all so sealed up. He said, oh, I'll get out of here. See, honestly, it was the best policy. You know, you just get straight through. So instead of hiding the truth from someone with the intention to avoid any happiness, sometimes if it's, you know, a case of don't ask, you know, don't say, or they don't ask, don't say, but to avoid any unhappiness, the right speech, sometimes you can get around that with what's called, like, you know, smart speech. You don't really say a lie. but sometimes it's, you know, it's not really sort of open. So anyway, but if they ask, just tell them. So sometimes, hide the truth from someone with intention of avoiding unhappiness, white speech. I do that very often, where people say, oh, Ajahn Brahm, can you please come to Sri Lanka again? Or can you please, or where can you please come through Queensland or to the Gold Coast again? And I say, well, I'll think about it. It's not really telling a lie, because I do think about it. And some invitations I've been thinking about for I don't know how many years. But and that avoids my unhappiness. Because if I say to you now, I don't have any time to do that, you say, oh, why not? And you keep badgering me and talking to me. And I have to say no many, many times. No, I can't do it. I'm too busy. I've got so many other things to do. No. And then after, I only have to say yes once. I said, oh, you said yes, and I've got to go. So that's one of the problems. I've got to be very careful with my energy levels and just making sure. So that's why, why did I say this to you? Because now you know the tricks. You say, where can you go again to Indonesia? Then I'll think about it. Yes, Ajahn Brahm, we know that. Now, when are you going? Ajahn Brahm, why do we get disappointed and how to deal with them? Do we get disappointed because we have two unrealistic expectations? That's why we get disappointed. You're asking from this world something this world can never give you. What do you expect? So what I expect is I can die at any time. There was actually, somebody was telling me about this English comedian, and he was doing a little comedy sketch, a stand-up comedian, about sort of dying, and he just slumped and stopped talking. People thought he was just joking, and 5 minutes later, he still hadn't moved, and they realised he really was dead. It's a wonderful way to go. You're going to go. Why not go that way? A few times, I know I'd see him shaking your head, Sumati. A few times, Ajahn Bamali was a bit scared, because sometimes I laugh at my own jokes. You know, probably I laugh at my own jokes more than anybody else. That's why I keep telling them. Sometimes you couldn't catch your breath and you were wheezing away. And Ajahn Bamali, quite a few times, got very, very scared. Ah, Ajahn Brahm, you're going to die. Laughing to death. Apparently somebody, I did actually Google in once, and somebody did actually, they died laughing. It was, I think it's a Greek sort of philosopher or something. And they died from laughing too much. It's not a bad way to go, is it? What do you reckon? Anyway. Okay. When becoming a monk, is it acceptable to like a best friend significantly more than everybody else? And is it inappropriate to show it? I don't know how you show it, but people always have their sort of Kalyana mittas, people who they're very close to. And even like Sariputta and Moggallana, really close friends. And so it was nice to have like close friends. And, you know, that because, you know, you have a lot of karma together, you know, you maybe grew up together, you joined the monastery together, of course you'll have close friends. But a close friend does not mean you exclude other friends. So it's just, you look at all people, all of your friends, especially in monastic life, all equal, you know, but some friends are more equal than others. And inappropriate to show it. Sometimes you've got to be careful because sometimes it can create a sense of jealousy and people can misunderstand it. But these are just people you've grown up with. So of course you have sort of people who are friends. even like, I don't know what it is, but even, you know, people like, when I first became a monk, Ajahn Chakwa was the abbot. So I spent so many years with him building up this place. So I still look at him as a really close, good friend. And so what happens is that, when is it, next June? I just, you know, go to visit him in Chicago, give a talk at his at the Theosophical Society there, where at least one thing he did do, because, you know, he was a good, really great counselor, very wise, but when he went to the United States, he couldn't use that as a job because he didn't have any qualifications. You know, he could teach a counseling course to others, but he hadn't got the degree to show that he'd gone through a course himself, so he was without a job. And so what can he do? What has he learned as a monk with Ajahn Chah over all those years which he could use for a qualification for a job? So he found the perfect job, a maintenance man. Because you know just how much work monks do. To actually, you know that, Nicholas, as we do all this work in our monasteries. You know, we learn how to fix things and mix concrete and do plumbing and do brickwork. So monks, if you don't actually get enlightened, at least you can have a trade in the building industry. So he got a job as a maintenance assistant, but later on they let him teach some meditation. Anyway, if you have a best friend, you have lots of best friends. Because you had lots of good times together in the past. Your monks look professional. Ooh. How do you train them? Do you scold them, shout at them, or to subdue them? Yeah, I really shout at them and hit them, but I make sure they never tell, because if they told how strict I was, then they'd get even into more trouble. Do I shout at you? See me in my office tonight. I just can't do that. Because I heard from one of your talks, which was given in one of the retreats in England for the Anucubha Bhikkhuni Project, you mentioned you'll use one of the books to teach your monks before or during their ordination so they get the right idea of becoming a monk. May I know what that book is? That was like the word of the Buddha. So at least they had some understanding of, you know, what, you know, Buddhism is. You know what happened once when Ajahn Chah was a monk? There was, an Italian man, I think. He ordained as a monk and never actually read on. He was, even though he was really interested in all the different religions, he was an ordained Catholic priest. But he was, you know, became a Buddhist monk as well. And then someone went to visit him and they found a bottle of wine in his kuti, in Wat Phapong. And he said, what's that doing there? Oh, it's just, you know, said, I have to do this because, you know, I'm an ordained Catholic priest, but I'm also a Buddhist monk. So I'm not doing this to get drunk or anything, but it's just, you know, the mass ceremony which I have to do. So that's one of the reasons why, when a person, that's the most extreme, but that's one of the reasons why when somebody comes to monk, at least I tell them what the precepts are, why the precepts, what are you doing this, and the teachings of rebirth and reincarnation. Because, you know, sometimes you meet some monks, not of my tradition, fortunately, and they don't even believe in reincarnation and rebirth. But I say, well, what do you believe in? Not much. So at least they know that's part of the Buddhist tradition. So they know exactly what a Buddhist monk is. What they're supposed to do. Dear Ajahn, can you please explain anatta? It is translated as non-self, but is there a better explanation? What was I teaching 2 days ago? You've forgotten it already. Anatta, not me, not mine. You don't own anything. It's not your will. It's not your knower. Both of these, I call these last two. The will and your consciousness as a last refuge for the illusion of a self. You all know your body is not you. I hope. It's obvious that it's not you. That's why I don't mind being fat. I'm not fat. It's not me. It's body's fat. I'm really thin inside. My body and me are totally different. You don't attach to your body, for goodness sake, come on. I don't identify with this body. But anyway, so you're not your body. So what else are you? What else are you? Are you your achievements, your memory? Are you your memory? Is that what makes you who you are? Because if it is, you're going. You forget. You lose your memory. You don't know what you were and what you did just a few moments ago. How many of you can remember right now where you put your sandals? I remember where I put my sandals. I didn't bring them. They're up by my room up the top there. But we think we remember, but do you? So our memories are so faulty, so it can't be your memory. So who else are you? Are you your will? Your choice, is that coming from you? Are you in control? The one who wrote this question, did you choose to write this question? Or did it just appear that you willed and freely chose to write this question? Where do you go shopping? Why do you buy what you buy in the shops? Is it really free choice? Or is it already conditioned by all the advertisements you have seen? And all of the conditioning and brainwashing that you have had to endure. You think that you are not influenced by advertising. I thought that until one day when I was a student, I saw a TV advertisement for St. Bruno tobacco. Because people like Albert Einstein, just great thinkers, they wouldn't smoke cigarettes or cigars, they'd smoke a pipe. And smoking a pipe was really cool in the 60s and 70s. It was like a sign that you were a great thinker, that you were a scholar, that you were someone who actually just was refined. Everyone would have a pipe. And in this advertisement, this ordinary looking young man, just like me. And he puts his Bruno tobacco in a pipe. He was walking down this road. And as soon as he put the tobacco in the pipe and lit it, the aroma just went into this shop where there's an impossibly beautiful blonde lady just working, you know, selling carrots. I mean, no one liked that. Just, they can get a job as a film star or something. But as soon as she smelt the aroma of St. Bruno tobacco, she was enchanted. And she left her station behind the lettuces and she went to follow this guy, totally entrapped, enamored by the fragrance of St. Bruno. And he didn't stop there. He went past the newsagent, this beautiful redhead came past and just followed him, and then after a few minutes had this whole like harem of just beautiful women just following him, just waiting to do his every command, because St. Bruno tobacco, the aroma is irresistible to beautiful women. I know, okay, this is the 70s, male fantasies, and I thought, well, let's try it. And I'm supposed to be intelligent. And I got some and smoked it down the road. And the only thing which followed me was a dog. That was, And I was like, well, how stupid can you get? And I'm supposed to be intelligent. It just catches you. You know, these advertisements which you have. But I thought, how many other advertisements have I followed in my life? Come to Jhana Grove and you will get jhanas. I better not go there. But anyway, anatta, so the will. And that's a scary thing, just to know how much you are brainwashed, how much you are influenced by your parents, your teachers, your culture, what you've read, what you see on the movies, what you put into your mind. It does condition you enormously. It makes you will. And when you see that, it's scary stuff. But after a while, your will vanishes and you realize it's not me. Just cause and effect, cause and effect, cause and effect. But then you go even deeper to the consciousness. What is this consciousness? What is this mind? And little by little, this is the one who's looking at me right now. The one who's hearing this. What is it? And then you find it vanishes. Nothing there. Just as the Buddha said, it's an illusion, a magician's trick. Nothing there. That is anatta. Can you accept that? Of course you can't. That was what Ajahn Chah did to me once, and that lovely anecdote, which you probably all know, at least I hope you know, that when I was just coming out of a great meditation, and then going to see my teacher, he was coming the opposite path, and he looked at me, and people can read minds. There are such things as psychic powers. You know, we just don't sort of talk about them much, except maybe me in the evening when just to entertain people, but it's not just entertainment, it's just interesting drama. So you can feel him going right in my mind and reading it. And of course I never stopped him, because for once my mind was really prepared to be read. For once it was actually quite pure. I'd just come out of a nice meditation and like, come inside, have a look. And after he messed around in there for a little bit, he came out and just, this is what it felt like. And then he looked at me and said, Brahma Wangsa, why? That's a really big question from a great monk. Why? And I looked at him. And I was truthful. I wasn't going to lie and tell him what he wanted to hear or just shut up. I just said, I don't know. Instead of scolding me, which I deserved, being stupid, he just laughed. Laughed and laughed and laughed. And then he stopped laughing and looked at me and said, Baba Wangsa, I'll tell you the answer. The answer to the question why, for one of the greatest monks in Thailand. Personal answer to a deep question. I thought, wow, this is exciting. No one else. Even these days, sometimes people would ask me, he said, did that really happen? I said, yeah, it did happen. You don't forget things like that. I said, the answer to the question why is, there's nothing. There's nothing. That's what anatta is. There's nothing. He looked at me again and said, do you understand? And I said, yes. He said, no, you don't. And he walked away. Oh, that was just so... I felt so stupid and so low and miserable and insignificant, and in front of such a great teacher. That's a great answer. You know, do you understand anatta? Of course you don't. You want me to explain it from just a question like this? Do you understand? Of course you don't. But you got the answer. You get the answer first, then you understand it. Ajahn, you did not really answer my question yesterday. Well, if you put it like that, I'm not going to answer it today. Okay. If there is no will, no one to do the practice, how does the process of enlightenment happen? It happens when you get out of the way and let it happen. Your will is what stops it happening. So, leave it alone and let it happen. Get out of the way and see what happens next. You know what happens though? People say, get out of the way. Okay, I'm not going to do anything. I'm just going to become enlightened. It's 4 days left. That's plenty of time. So I'm not going to do anything at all. I'm just going to sit here and just... Hasn't happened yet. It's not working. Come on. You don't give it time to happen. So just don't do anything for the next 4 days. Let go of your will. Can you do that? It's scary. Those of you who have been scared of ghosts, what can a ghost do for you? There's nothing there. Oh, like the ghost, the big devils come and say, I've come to take over your mind. As they said that to me, so you can have it. Nothing there. Or they say, like in Christianity, to sell your soul to the devil. And the devil came up and said, Atom Pound, how much for your soul? I said, well, actually, what do we need for fundraising? And I said, okay, you can have it. And I said, the devil gets a bum deal. I don't have a soul, there's nothing in there. It's just emptiness. So the devil gets emptiness and nothing, there's nothing there, as Ajahn Chah said, and I get all this money which we can use to do something for somewhere. Good deal, isn't it? So I thought sometimes, when you get into the Church Times or something, Ajahn Brahm, soul for sale to the highest bidder. We have Gumtree, isn't it, Gumtree, where you can sell things? eBay, that's even better, that's much wider. So next time we'll do a fundraiser. What we're doing was a fundraiser for the Newbury Monastery. That's a good fundraiser. We can put on eBay, Ajahn Brahm, soul for sale to the highest bidder. That would actually get a lot of interest, wouldn't it? There's nothing there, so what have you got to lose? Do you understand? No, of course you don't. Anyway, is it normal to meditate with visualizing oneself parachuting from nowhere, and as one falls down, the stair starts disintegrating and left with bones until even the bones disintegrated into nothingness? I started with only parachuting, but somehow the storyline turned this way. Wasn't feeling scared, but just enjoying the ride. Thanks, Ajahn. Are there any psychology? No, that's excellent. So visualize yourself parachuting from nowhere. It reminds me of the two men. And they're on the top of a cliff. And one of them had a little bird cage and had like a canary in the cage, like a budgerigar in the cage. And the other one had a parrot on his shoulder. And the first one, they looked down, it's maybe, at least 100 meters, 200 meters cliff, right down to the bottom. And without saying anything, the man with the budgerigar in the cage jumped off, and hurtling to his death. And the budgerigar saw what was happening. He's being held in the cage, and so, you know, he would die too. So the budgerigar started flapping his wings as hard as he could. Now, the budgerigar can fly, but he had to actually fly carrying the weight of his owner who was jumped off the cliff. And the budgerigar started flapping harder and harder and harder and harder, and the man started slowing down because of, you know, the budgerigar's, you know, just flying. And flying harder and harder and harder and harder and harder and harder and harder. just to save his own life, let alone the guy holding the cage. And the guy slowed down, when he got to the bottom, then he was still, falling very slowly, but he just bent his legs, straightened himself up. He survived the fall. And the poor budgerigar was on its back, gasping, but he saved the life. And the other guy, with the parrot on the shoulder, he jumped off too. But this time, only about halfway down, hurtling to his death, he got out a gun and shot the parrot. And then he started slowing down, until he just got to the bottom and needed to bend his legs. He landed as soft as a feather. But the poor parrot was dead. But they looked at each other, and the one with the budgerigar in the cage said, "Here he comes. Put your fingers in your ear if you don't like this. This bungee jumping is very good, but it's not as good as parachuting." Bungee jumping and parachuting. Okay, Ping Pong's got the giggles now. Oh, come on. I know you've heard it before. But he's... but you're from the Punjab. Anyway, so it's great. Those things are good. So anyway... those visualizations. I say that's a nice visualization because it means that you're just letting go and just falling down and just not hurting yourself and things disintegrating, letting go, going to nothingness. It's great because it's the sign that you're just getting these emptiness perceptions. My mind keeps wandering off into fantasies about the nice meditations I've had in the hall. It doesn't seem to help much and just leaves me tired. Is there any skillful way to work with this? Thanks and metta. Oh, so if you do go into the nice meditation, remember the nice meditation you've had before, don't just use it as a thought, just feel it. Feel some of the good qualities of your previous really good meditations. Just like we did this morning when I asked you to imagine you're the Buddha under the Bodhi tree. Remember that. Or, if you can't really get into that, just sometimes I say, close your eyes and remember the most peaceful, contented experience you've ever had in your life. A time when you just close your eyes and where you were just so peaceful, so happy. Yeah, you had difficulties and problems in the life and work to be done, but you just put it aside for that time. And you're with someone, the people you liked, and you, if you had a genie, said any wish, you say, no, this is just good enough at this moment. It could be in a monastery, it could be in a mountain, in a cave, it could be by the river or the lake somewhere, or by the ocean side. You remember that you felt so peaceful, so content. And once you start recording the most peaceful, content moment of your life, or at least one of them, then you start to fill in the details. You know, was it a blue sky or a cloudy sky? Was it warm? Was it cool? Was it inside? Who was with you? What were you wearing? Where were you sitting? Or were you standing? Or were you lying down? As you fill in the details, you reinforce the peace, the contentment, the not wanting anything, the stillness, the joy. And as you keep painting the picture more and more and more, it solidifies, it stabilizes the joy, peace and happiness. And after 5 minutes or 10 minutes, depending, then you let go of all those details. And what you're left with is the echo, the stillness, the peace, the joy. The most wonderful time you've ever had. So, it's not a bad thing. Fantasy about the nice meditation you've had in this hall, but don't just think about them. Start to feel them. start to internalize why it was just a good meditation, what it felt like. You start to feel those sensations, feel those experiences, feel that peace and happiness. And then you let it go. And again, you're way ahead in the path of meditation. It gives you just a big kickstart. Thanks for building such a wonderful place. During these 4 days, I ate, slept, sat and walked. The delicious food makes me gain weight. Now you can understand my predicament. Can I do some exercise, e.g. run jogging during noble silence? Thank you. As long as you can run silently. With no panting. So, yeah, of course you can do some exercise. But one of the best exercises is cleaning the floor, is actually washing the dishes. So useful exercise is a good thing to do. But if you've done all the useful exercises by helping others, then you can just go running up and down. Dear Ajahn Brahm, sutra is complicated for me. If I only do dana, precepts and a little bit of meditation, we pray our good Buddhist. Well, okay. Of course you will, because you do dana, keep precepts, and meditate. And after a while, the meditation really takes off. You good Buddhist, bad Buddhist? Who knows? Because sometimes people do a lot of meditation, and are they good Buddhists? Who knows? So it just depends upon, you can't judge people. Why is cow's milk not an allowable food in the afternoon, but cheese is? That is one of the great koans in Buddhism. And the only way you can answer that and find a deep answer is go and find the cow. There's a cow somewhere here. And ask the cow. Get it from the source. So why is your milk not allowed but cheese is? That is your task. Ajahn, I used to do physical exercise daily. What sort of thing about exercise? I was told it's just like you only have a certain amount of energy given to you in life. If you use it all up when you're young, then you won't have any energy left when you're old. So conserve your energy. And in order to actually not leave such a big carbon footprint, for footprint you have to walk or run. So I go in cars, so if I don't leave any footprints. People didn't think that was a good excuse. Okay, anyway. I used to do physical exercise daily, then I died. No? I used to do physical exercise daily. When you attend a retreat like this, how much physical exercise you need? Please advise. It's just the right amount. Middle way. Middle way. In the middle. Could you please explain how important the Buddha put on metta as a factor to enlightenment? Really important. It's just the second factor of the Eightfold Path. First factor, letting go, renouncing, nekama. Second factor of the second part of the Eightfold Path is metta. It's part of the path. Eightfold Path, number 2, part 2, metta. That's how important it is. Nimitta Rajana is too far for me to achieve. How do you know it's too far for you to achieve? Sometimes you think, well, this is impossible. What was it some years ago? There was this gentleman came for one of the retreats about 2 or 3 years ago. And I just happened to be standing by the registration counter. I don't know who was supposed to be registering, but they weren't there. And I saw them. There was this big guy full of tattoos, really rough, just really curly hair. And when I saw his tattoos, You know, I just stereotyped him, judged him. Stupid, Ajahn Brahm, but I did. And I said, excuse me, sir, I think you got the wrong place. The prison farm, if you want to visit your friends, is up there. He said, no, I'm booked on your retreat. I've never seen him before. He said, I'm booked on, and I checked his name. Yeah, he was down there. So, okay, all right, well, here's your room. So it really surprised me, just some people actually, because you book online. So I don't know what you look like, and I don't know where you come from. If you get there quick enough, you know, then you're in. So I was really surprised. Where did this guy come from? There's just so many taps on him. But then, having, you know, made a stupid mistake by judging a person by what they look like, then during the interviews he came along and said, oh, I need to talk to you about my meditation. And he started talking about what's happening. And I was just, wow, my eyes went wide. It was a jhana. This was one of the star meditators of that retreat. And honestly, the last person I'd ever think would have got jhanas on that retreat, and there's this guy with all the tattoos. So whoever wrote this, Nimitra jhana is too far for me to achieve. Go to the tattoo parlor, get some tattoos. And that might increase your chance. Now, of course, it's nothing to do with the tattoos or anything. It was just, you can't know, you can't judge. The way the Buddha described it, and this is serious, he said sometimes you've got this big water jar and it's higher, you know, than the top of your head. So you can't actually see just if it's empty or if it's middle full or almost to the top. All you can see is just water coming in. You never know when it's going to overflow. Sometimes you think there's hardly any water in there at all, but it's really close to the top. Sometimes you think, wow, it must be really close to the top now, and it's almost empty. But then one day you're meditating and it just comes to the top and it flows over. You've got a jhana. You don't know when it's going to happen. That's an amazing thing. Too far for you to achieve? Who knows? I'm content if I can become a better person. You don't need to become a better person. Just be who you are. Otherwise, I wouldn't recognize you. Is it not a correct view of Buddhism? Yeah, but just be contented, even if you don't become a better person. Who are you anyway? You're good enough. So just be content. What was it? This person went to see his psychologist because he could never find a partner, someone to share his life with. And so the psychologist said, well, have a look in the mirror. Look, your teeth just are all crooked and yellow. And look at your hair. It's just, you know, it's not properly groomed. And look at your clothes. They're just so old-fashioned. You're not attractive enough. And now you look at your, what else about sort of grooming and personal appearance. And look at your confidence. You need a coach, basically, to make sure you're more confident. And so he took the psychologist's advice and he went to, you know, an expensive dentist, got all his teeth straightened. He got his, you know, expensive hair sort of salon or something to make his hair just really cool, and got an expensive suit and many years going with a coach to make sure that, you know, he's really confident, even learning how the way to walk, you know, better. And then after doing all of that, he got his expensive suit, and the first time he went out to a singles club to meet someone, as he was just walking across the road, he got hit by a truck and killed. And so when he went up to heaven, he was really upset. And he said, God, you know, you didn't even give me one day. I spent all this money and all this hard work, you know, trying to get my personal appearance looking good, and you didn't even give me one day. What are you that for? And of course, you know the punchline. So God said, well, it's a mistake. We didn't recognize you. Okay. Now, one of the things that I tell these jokes for is actually to teach you the noble truth of suffering. This joke before. Okay, anyway. Is it true at the later stage of meditation the mind is more sensitive to thoughts, i.e. more fragile? Not fragile so much as just even like the slightest will just agitates it. But not fragile. I get excited when the breath arises, nimitta comes out. How can I overcome this? The excitement seems to be useful when calming body and mind, but at a later stage it seems to distract the practice. Yeah, so what you do is you make the resolution, the programming your mindfulness. Begin in the meditation and say to yourself, if I get excited, I will calm down. In your own words, usually three times, program your mindfulness. It's like setting up like an antivirus. It has to be specific and clear. Three times, pay attention, which means your really program is getting in. That's one of the reasons why advertisements on TV worked. Because, you know, they were interesting, they were alluring, they grabbed your attention, they got under your radar. And so you didn't realize you were being programmed. But here you do it to quite aware that you're programming your mindfulness. If excitement comes up, I will calm it down. And then you forget you just carry on meditating, you don't repeat the instructions anymore. And it's wonderful how it works. You start to get excited, and then you remember, just calm it down. You don't even say anything, it's pre-verbal. You calm it down and you get so peaceful. And if you don't want to find out just how this works or get some confidence that it does work, that is when tonight, when you go to bed, before you go to sleep, you program yourself what time you're going to wake up tomorrow morning. So, you know, you set your alarm clock to whatever time you want to get up, and you say to yourself, I will wake up at 3 a.m. tomorrow morning. I wake up. You only set your alarm clock just in case, 5 minutes past three. You don't know how much you like getting up early in the morning. I will wake. Not 3 o'clock? 4 o'clock? 5 o'clock? Okay, 5 minutes to seven. So you don't, so you don't miss breakfast. So you say to yourself, I will wake up at 10 minutes to seven. I'll wake up at 10 minutes to seven. I will wake up at 10 minutes to seven. And you really mean it. Set your alarm clock for 5 to 7, just in case, so you don't get afraid. But you know, whatever time it is, try it. Make a resolution. And then, it's amazing just how many times that works. You're sleeping and you open your eyes and don't know what time it is, and you look at the clock and it's 10 minutes to seven. It works. How does that work? It is simple conditioning, cause and effect, programming your mind. And that means that you can do that to yourself to overcome meditation obstacles, especially in the deeper stages of meditation, which is sensitive in the sense if you do anything, you know, you really will sort of block progress. You have to be very still. So all you do is just tell yourself, if this happens at this particular time, I will come out. I will not get excited. I was saying that coming out because that's how meditators, if you often get into deep meditations, sometimes you can be in meditations a long time, you can miss your aircraft, you can miss giving your talks. So you tell yourself, I have to come out of meditation at, I don't know, maybe at 7 p.m. or 7:30 to be able to give the Dhamma talk or answer the questions. So actually you program, say how long you're going to be in there. Otherwise, you stay in these jhanas and you don't know what time it is. You're in the present moment and you don't know anything except the bliss of the jhanas, and sometimes you can just let people down. Anyway, Dear Ajahn Brahm, I have been getting lucid dreams past two afternoons where I am aware I am dreaming and could also hear my own snores. It took some effort to wake myself up when I felt tired and not well rested. After that, could it be I overate for lunch? Your prognosis, please. Thanks so much. The food is fantastic. It is hard not to overeat for lunch. Okay, it could be that you are overeating and just sleeping the wrong time or the wrong place. But to wake yourself up, again, do the programming of your mindfulness. I will not eat too much. I will not eat too much. I will not eat too much. And just say it, don't add anything, because sometimes people say, I will not eat too much. What is too much anyway? And this is not really too much, it's just, you know, look at the person next to me, look how much they eat. So, no, just use a little bit of restraint, because otherwise what happens is that you just lose the opportunity of having just the right amount of food and just being able to have a nice, energetic body. But anyway, to wake yourself up, if that happens, I would use to programming mindfulness. Will you please talk about the permissibles in the afternoon? Thanks so much. Oh, those permissibles in the afternoon. Just why do you want to... Sometimes you like being a lawyer. You know, what is allowed, what is not allowed. And instead of saying, you know, cheese allowed, milk allowed, soy milk is allowed, sugar is allowed, honey is allowed, why is it just a lot of unhealthy things are allowed in the afternoon and the healthy things you can't eat in the afternoon, but you can eat them in the afternoon or evening. And so some of the permissibles, as I remember that Sambit Gia, my preceptor, said, when I was asking him, well, cheese, milk, you know, why? He said, look, why do you want to have something in the evening? So it's only if you just, you know, really need a boost of energy. It's not just for the sake of eating because of the sake of eating. And then I've been living sort of the monastic life for 44 years and don't have anything in the afternoon, maybe a cup of tea. You know, just over here you give me some cheese, but I don't eat any cheese over in Bodhinyana Monastery. Cheese is bad in Bodhinyana Monastery. That's why you see many monks coming over here in the afternoon. When is there a retreat on? That's true. You have chocolate, but it has to be dark chocolate, but then you say, it's got dark chocolate, it's got any nuts in it, it's got this in it and that, and I'll just, if you need to eat it, just eat it. So sometimes, just to try and to be a lawyer, it's not so much if it's permissible by its content. Is it going to be helpful to you, according to your meditation? If it is, then okay. Dear Ajahn, this is a path without groaning. Could you please advise which sutta the Buddha said this, and what is the Pali phrase for this translation? And that was Venerable Jnana Tiloka's translation. It's in the word of the Buddha, the first version. And when I saw that, I thought, wow, this is great. A path without groaning. In other words, there's so many other things you have to do in your life. It's just really hard work. And actually to see, I don't actually, can't quote this, but it's in the word of the Buddha, the original version by Jnana Tiloka. So you can get that from somewhere and just find it. But, and then you've got to find a Pali phrase for it too. But without groaning, as soon as I saw that, I said, wow, why is it that when people just try and do something, they think it's really hard work, and the harder the work, no gain without pain. And then, is that the way of our life? Is that what I want to sort of spend years and years and years and years groaning and groaning and moaning and groaning before you get enlightened? And so you see something like this and think, wow, this is interesting. And of course, it accords with the Noble Eightfold Path. Oh, sorry, the Four Noble Truths. I mentioned this the first day. What is the second noble truth? Wanting leads to suffering. If you like, it leads to groaning. So if you don't want, the third noble truth, letting go leads to the end of suffering, to non-groaning. So if you are groaning in your meditation. You're frustrated, you're tired, you're fed up, you're moaning and groaning, maybe not inside, but you think, oh, we go again. Why are there so many jokes and not real dhamma? Why aren't we just Ajahn Brahm force us to get up early and do this and moaning and groaning? That's obviously not the path. But if it's contented and easily satisfied, no groaning, but just being, then you find you're letting go. That's the path. And you feel peaceful, you feel happy. So if you had a difficult meditation, it's not you can't meditate, it's what you're wanting. You're controlling. So if there's any groans or moans, if you've been wanting something, and you get frustrated, disappointed, because you wanted something. Imagine you don't want anything at all in the whole world. Just happy to be here. You're letting go of craving, of wanting. Then, there's happiness. And that happiness gets deeper and deeper. It becomes the path. It goes all the way into incredible bliss and profound freedom, regardless of enlightenment. Anyway, I had a peaceful meditation today thanks to your sublime sharing of delightful breathing. I tried it sitting at the cottage room when it was absolutely peaceful at 3 p.m. today. My old aching, poor and degenerating body decided to move around on its own in the middle of my sublime breathing. I let it continue twisting around, but I'm curious, why do lights come into my vision while I was aware my body was moving around and the lights disappeared when my body finished twisting, but instead I got into dark and peaceful meditation without any lights coming to my vision. Thanks a zillion. Ajahn. What's this? Streaks of white blue come at corner sometimes as random shapes in front. Okay. So what was happening there? Because you were content and you just let the body go. You stopped controlling the body. Yeah, you can feel a little bit of the body, but just the fact that you're not controlling it, you're letting it go, so it twists around. Why it twists around, I don't know, but there's probably some injury somewhere. Or some opening up of channels of energy, so it can have some curing. So you're aware of that, but you still have the lights coming up, the nimittas. So what is actually happening, the usual explanation? This is the amplitude, the strength of your five senses. This is the strength of your mind, your jitta, the six senses. Most times, your five senses, because they get most of your attention, are so strong. Feed them so much energy. So the mind is actually quite weak. And as you subdue, calm down your five senses, they get calm and calm and calm. And the energy starts to go into the knower. In this particular case, the mind. And soon the mind gets about to the same amplitude. So you start seeing the mind, even though you can still see some of the five senses. So the mind gets really strong. So you can see the nimittas. And eventually those get very, very weak, and the nimitta gets strong and dominates. And that's where you just see nimittas and none of the five senses. But what happens sometimes? Sometimes you get some really a string of very deep meditation. So when you come out, the nimitta is there. Sometimes it's there all the time. And so you have to eat your food, you know, through the nimitta. Like getting the food and just, because the nimitta is there all the time. So you can still see the nimitta. The nimitta is a sign that your mind is very powerful and very strong. How can I be free from hatred and ill will towards a person? It is just don't be a prosecutor, be a defense attorney. Give them kindness, compassion. You don't know why they did that, but just because they did something bad does not make them a bad person. You're just watching the two bad bricks in the wall. And a hatred and a will towards a person is what you're actually doing. Think of that person. They've done lots of good in this world as well as bad things to you, and you're just focusing on the bad stuff. And it just makes you sick, having hatred and ill will towards a person. It's much better to give them the benefit of the doubt, let it go, and then you can be peaceful. Otherwise, you are just hurting yourself. I don't know what they did, but say the example. Someone calls you a bad name. They call you stupid. What do you do? They've got no right to call me stupid. Why are they calling me stupid? That's not the right thing to tell me, so I'm stupid. And you find that every time you remember what they said, they're calling you stupid again. And actually, they're probably right. You are stupid to keep remembering it. So every time you remember why they hurt you, or the time they hurt you, you're allowing them to hurt you again. So why do you keep allowing the person to take away your happiness by allowing your hatred and ill will towards them to persist? Dear Ajahn, what is the meaning of Tathagata? It is just the way the Buddha called himself. He just called himself, instead of calling himself the Buddha, called himself Tathagata. And scholars have argued for centuries about what that word really means. But instead of calling himself me or I, so that was the word the Buddha called himself, Tathagata. So sometimes even they ask me, so what is the right way of addressing you? And I usually say, HR, Ajahn Brahm. You know what HR means? His roundness. Or sometimes his emptiness is a good one. His emptiness, Ajahn Brahm. Oh, what else can you call me? Oh yeah, instead of Ajahn Brahm, Ajahn Donuts. And actually, on a retreat here, somebody suggested that. I thought that was really cool. So why do you call, what does Ajahn Donut mean? So it's the same as asking, you know, maybe just sort of, what does Tathagata mean? What does Donut mean? Why does Ajahn Brahm call himself Ajahn Donut? And the answer is, number one, donuts are round. Number two, they're sweet. And number three, they're holy in the middle. So what does Tathagata mean? Maybe you can find out. Talking about karma. I wasn't talking about karma. It's supposed to be noble silence here, no talking. But anyway, what is the actions that will lead to richness? It's so that I can visit you more often. What the karma in this life which will lead to being more wealthy is work hard, spend little. Is that what you want to hear? No, you want the easy way. Okay, there was this gentleman, I'm just rushing through these pieces, excuse me, there's only 5 minutes to go. There was this gentleman who spent a year at Bodhinyana Monastery as an Anagarika, then went back to continue his studies at, I think, Frankfurt University or somewhere in Frankfurt. And he told me the first day on campus he passed an ATM machine. And because he'd been brainwashed by me, he gave it loving kindness. Especially, that's right, first of all, the ATM made a sound. He called it a gurgling sound as he passed it. And he thought maybe the ATM machine was welcoming him onto campus. So, you know, he said, you know, good morning or whatever it was. And then he always, when he passed it, gave it loving kindness. Every day he passed the ATM machine. Just may your banknotes never run out. May no one ever just bash you because they found they've got no balance left in their account. May no one ever rob you. May your electricity never sort of cut out with a power surge or whatever. And he was always very kind to the ATM. And he said after a while, he didn't say actually how long, he was having his lunch on a bench close by to the ATM. And he said no one had been close to it for all the time he was there, maybe half an hour, when he heard the sound again, the gurgling sound. And he looked around and a 20 euro note came out from the machine. No one had put any credit card in. No one had pressed any buttons. No one had been close to the machine all the time he was having his lunch. So he went over to the machine and took out the 20 euros, waved it around. Did this belong to anybody? Of course it didn't. So he put it in his pocket. This is what happens when you have loving kindness. So if you want, which will lead to riches, develop lots of loving kindness, especially when you pass ATM machines. May all ATM machines be happy and well. May you always have lots of extra cash inside of you. Now cough up. How to let it go. How to let it go, you will find in the dining area, there is the letting go box, which is otherwise known as donation box. So that, how to let it go, it's not hard. So you take out the note from your wallet and you put it in the little envelope and then you put it into the donation box. That's how you let go. I remember the fundraiser in Kuala Lumpur some years ago. Really good MC there. He said, well, this is a Buddhist fundraiser, so you have to do it. We have to do some meditation before we do the fundraising. And he said, a body awareness, mindfulness. So he said to everybody, raise your right hand slowly. And everyone raised it, it's mindfulness. Be mindful, you do it slowly with full awareness. And then put it under your jacket on the left side, mindfully. Mindfully take out your wallet. That was the mindfulness. Unfortunately, people actually started laughing before they actually took any money out, but it was a good try. Okay. How do you suggest relating to the pleasures of life, sunset, breakfast, sex, skillfully supporting renunciation? If you just watch the sunset, you don't get babies. If you have breakfast, it all turns into, you know, brown stuff afterwards. But if you have sex, that is very complicated. You know, you get sort of all these emotional entanglements afterwards. So that's actually how to relate to them. Get the simple ones which don't entangle you. So that you can watch a sunset and you don't have to see a lawyer afterwards because, you know, you didn't get permission to watch the sunset. Those simple pleasures are the best. So that's actually related to the pleasures of life, if you really want to. But if, you know, you do want sex, make sure it is consensual. But, you know, watching a sunset, you know, sometimes it's always like peaceful, but sometimes, you know, you just lose yourself. You get so entangled, so drawn in, you don't know sometimes what you're doing. And that's where people get into big problems. Say with alcohol and drugs. Now, the drugs are pleasurable, but you don't know what you're doing, and sometimes before you know it, good people end up in big problems. Now, for the real Atasila, the eight precepts, what can we eat afternoon? Is milk allowed or only sweet, honey, dark chocolate, juice or barley? Can we eat fruit as long as not big as our palm? Oh my goodness me. Sorry?
Third question on the same subject.
Exactly, yeah. So the real atmosphere, everyone's got different ideas. So I know sometimes in some places you can have milk, in some places you can't, sometimes you have soy milk, sometimes you can't. So sometimes people have coffee mate instead of milk or soy milk. And apparently, I think this was invented in Chittas Monastery. Because they had this list of things which were allowable. And so they started making chocolate ice cream made with Coffee Mate. They're very innovative. It really would make you sick. But now, why did they do those things? So anyway, it's not to indulge the senses. If you need something just to make sure you've got some energy, and it's not just craving and wanting, it really is you need something, then okay. As for me, I'm just happy with a cup of tea. You don't need these other things. So that means, don't make too much big a deal of it. What's more important, instead of thinking, you know, what can you eat in the afternoon and what can you not eat in the afternoon, just eat a nice lunch. So you don't really feel hungry in the afternoon. And just meditate. And have more concern about how to develop peaceful contentment than about the legalities of what's allowable in the afternoon. What comes out of your mouth is more important than what goes into your mouth. Which is a nice place for me to stop getting things coming out of my mouth. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. Okay. So again, I was rushing for those last questions. So if I didn't answer them to your satisfaction, tough luck. No, you can ask them again tomorrow, if we can. Ho, ho, ho. Mm-hmm.